Come on.
Spending too much time on social? Is your daily screen time over 2 hours? Are you a little bit overweight? Not saving enough money? Any or all of these are familiar. Strive could be for you. The Strive 2-week online bootcamp will help you to detox your mind, body, and money, getting you on your way to a happier, healthier, wealthier, and more confident life. Go to strivedetox.com, strivedetox.com, and get your mind, body, and money right. Welcome to Money Savage, Savage Approach to Personal Finance. This is George Grombacher, and the time is right. Welcome to today's guest, the strong and powerful Romina Baca. Romina, are you ready to do this?
Yes, thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, welcome back. Romina is a fiscal and economic expert. She's a public speaker, panel moderator, and the director of the Grover M. Herman Center for the Federal Budget at the Heritage Foundation. And again, I'm excited to have you back on. Romina, I know you told us a little bit about it last time, but tell us a little bit more about your personal life, some more about your work, and why it is that you do what you do.
Yeah, I live in Washington, D.C. now, and have been living in this area for about 15 years, advising members of Congress, the administration, but also speaking to the public about our nation's fiscal challenges and how we can address them. And the reason I'm really in this business and why I became an economist is because I wanted to understand what makes people and societies thrive and what creates poverty and problems in society. And economics has been really an effective lens for me to understand the world in a better way, and that policy really matters for people and the opportunities that they will face in their lives. And so I decided to go into policy to work towards creating that better environment where all people have an opportunity to thrive, to realize their full potential, and to live the American dream, which has been very much my experience. I'm an immigrant from Germany, and I just became a U.S. citizen last August.
That's right. I remember seeing that online. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
That's awesome. And I was so grateful for you to be able to come on last time. And I really wanted to find an expert, somebody who could speak to the deficit and the federal debt. And I feel like you did such a great job at that. And then I had another conversation with somebody who told me that there's no reason that anybody should be thinking about the federal deficit. It's just not important. And it just made me shake my head and sort of realize that there's so many things that we are focused on as a country, particularly from a political standpoint, that we're not thinking enough about the current impact that the debt has and the deficit, and then what it's going to look like, you know, 20, 30 years from now, if we don't change anything. And then I saw that you recently published an article talking about this very thing. So just wanted to sort of kick it off and talk about, it's been about a year. So how are we doing with the deficit?
Yeah, it's gotten much worse. Some of it we saw coming, including 5 years ago when President Obama started touting that the deficit was falling. And I think some of the decline in interest in our fiscal situation and the deficit stems from that period where for roughly 3-4 years in a row, every State of the Union, the president touted his success at reducing the deficit. What he didn't mention was that part of that was because there was actually a law in place, the Budget Control Act of 2011, that kept down spending that led to fierce negotiations between Republicans and Democrats and actually kept a lid on spending growth. Since President Trump came into office, those spending deals have become much, much worse. The president has been willing to cut much bigger deals with Democrats than President Obama was cutting with Republicans. And in part, it stems from the president's primary interest, not in addressing our fiscal situation, but first and foremost, to rebuild a military that he thinks suffered under the last administration. And so in the interest of boosting defense spending, the president has agreed to massive increases in non-defense domestic spending, which the Democrats demand in exchange. The result of all this has been that the first budget deal that President Trump cut with the congressional Democrats ended up being bigger than all of the budget deals under the Obama administration combined. And then they just cut another one last year that was about the same size. So it's been incredible. Spending has gone up significantly, which is why it's no surprise that the deficit has now climbed above $1 trillion for this year and will be rising steeply from there. We'll be in $1 trillion deficit territory for the foreseeable future, approaching almost $2 trillion by the end of this decade. And that's assuming we don't have a economic decline, a recession in between now and then, because these are, you know, best circumstance scenario projections.
Wow. Okay. So the cause of a lot of this is politicking. It's President Trump wanting to be able to spend a bunch of money on the military, and the Congress saying, okay, but we need to spend on these domestic programs as well.
That's right. That's where that agreement comes in. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, the deficit went up because of the tax cuts. Now, the tax revenue that the federal government is collecting actually went up. Just between 2019 to 2020, from 2018 to 2019, the latest data that we have, the revenues climbed by 4% over that 1 year period, despite the tax cuts because of the growing economy. But what people fail to mention is that spending grew at twice the rate, at 8%. And it's that's what's causing the deficit, is that higher revenues are chasing ever higher spending. And in the long run, that is highly unsustainable, because the government can only spend and use up the resources that the economy first created. And you can only tax as much as, you know, your economy can bear to pay. And as the government uses up more resources and chooses to forego paying for them in the current period, but could impose much higher taxes in the future to address the growing national debt, which is the result of, you know, annual deficits adding on top of each other, those higher taxes can significantly constrain our economy. And that's where some of the concern comes in, is that today's spending is not for productivity enhancing investments. Most of the deficit spending the federal government does is purely for consumption. They are mostly transfer payments in the form of various entitlements, welfare programs. Healthcare is a big one, and Social Security is the other elephant in the room. And so we're spending all this money on deficit without creating future prosperity, but actually undermining the ability of the younger generation and the next generation to be able to live as well as this generation has, or to be able to live even better. We're mortgaging the future with current policies, and that assumes that we'll be able to continue doing this for a while, and the government can just raise taxes at some point. It doesn't account for the real and growing risk that we might have an actual fiscal crisis.
So, has it been the case historically that when there's a contraction, that spending will go down?
Actually, the opposite. When we have an economic contraction, we have so-called automatic stabilizing policies in place that kick in, that, for example, means that more people will be on welfare programs, more people will qualify for Medicaid and other subsidies. So spending tends to go up during economic contractions. And then you also find politicians of both parties, they get confused and they think because government spending is one of the factors that we count in GDP, that if they spend more money on government stuff, that that's going to boost GDP, and they think that that means that the economy will be stronger. So we usually find politicians adopting some type of stimulus package to try and boost GDP in this recession. At the same time, tax revenues contract. They do contract, and that's because the recession is basically we have a decline in production and demand in the economy. And so as businesses make less money, people become unemployed, businesses don't tend to expand as much during recessions, the government is able to collect less revenue. So you have a drop in revenue, a steep increase in spending, and you usually end up with massive deficits during recessions for that reason.
So if I'm getting this right, when times are good, we should be putting some money away, because when times are bad, we'll need to spend more of it.
That's right. And that is what smart, prudent countries around the world practice. And I want to name a few, because unfortunately, the United States is not on this list. In fact, the United States is currently the top industrialized country that is adding debt at a faster rate compared to the growth in our economy, and we're one of the fastest growing economies than any other country. So we are like the number one debt increaser. That's what we are right now, which is really not the top spot that we want to hold. But if you look at some countries that have adopted good policies, like you suggest, make room and create some fiscal space for when times are tough, when the economy is in decline, by saving, by spending less when the economy is strong, and create some surpluses so you have those funds available to paper over when times are tough. And in Switzerland, they have the so-called debt brake. Germany has a similar policy. Basically, what they do is they constrain government spending during times of economic strength, which is also good for the private sector, because if the private sector is strong and the government is doing too much spending, it actually takes resources away from the private sector. If you think every person employed by the government is a person not available to work in a private sector capacity, those are real resources that get used up. And also any resources, like when the government builds a big infrastructure project, are resources not available to the private sector. It can drive up the cost of steel and cement and all these other inputs that are also used in private sector construction. So that's the crowd out. But yeah, so Switzerland, Sweden, Germany, even Canada, they've adopted all these prudent policies. These are often referred to as counter-cyclical balancing policies, where you allow for deficits during times of distress, but you curtail deficits and government spending to make room for the private sector when the economy is strong. Right now, we're doing the opposite. We are the federal government is spending at a rising rate. We have deficits that we haven't had since 2012, when we were still climbing out of the Great Recession, and yet our economy is one of the strongest that it can be, with unemployment super low, and the government should be retreating at this point, but instead they're doubling down.
And everything you just said, it certainly intellectually makes sense to me. And now it completely makes sense to me when you explain it, and then you talk about countries that are exercising, I guess, proper proper behaviors. If you were to ask somebody, counter, if somebody wanted to argue that the deficit wasn't a problem, would it simply be that look at the growth of our economy and we don't need to worry about it because we are growing so fast?
So I've heard a number of arguments from what I call the deficit deniers.
Okay.
And one of them is, if trillion-dollar deficits were a problem, how come our economy is growing so strongly? But we also have evidence that since 2014, our economy likely grew about one percentage point more slowly than it otherwise otherwise would have if the government hadn't had such high deficits and debt. This is by done a study by the Mercatus Center that identified there was about a 1/3 reduction in potential growth that we could have had if it hadn't been for government spending, and particularly deficit spending, crowding out activity in the private sector. So, you know, our economy is growing, but the latest numbers are roughly 2.3%. There's no reason why we couldn't be growing at 3% or above. And I do believe that our high government spending and growing deficits are contributing to that lesser growth. And one of the channels that that's happening is by increasing uncertainty. When a business makes an investment, they don't just think about what the economy is doing today, but depending on the investment, they're thinking 5, 10, 15, 20 years ahead of time. And if you look at our fiscal situation and where we are in the business cycle, right now we're in one of the longest expansions with the economy growing and no recession in the history of this country. Businesses are expecting that there will be another downturn, in part because of the bad policies that led to the last one that we didn't fix, but that our government actually doubled down on in many ways. And they're expecting that taxes will likely have to be higher in the future, reducing the return on investment from investments they make today. And why do they expect that? Because our deficit and debt are highly unsustainable, and it can't go on forever. At some point, something's going to have to change. And one of the likely results of this, given our politics, will be that even though it's not tax revenue, a lack of tax revenue driving our deficits, in order to cut a political bargain, taxes will likely be raised. And that might include businesses.
I can't see a scenario where if we continue at the current rate that they wouldn't go up.
Exactly. If you're a smart businessman, that's what you expect would expect as well. Another reason I've heard, and this is a more recent reason that people are giving, is this idea of they call it modern monetary theory, which they argue that, first of all, there's an assumption that government spending is good for the economy. We should get that assumption straight. There's no concern about the fact that government spending actually has a negative multiplier, because for every dollar the government spends, the economy doesn't get a dollar in extra benefit. It gets more like between 40 and 60 cents, depending on where that money goes, because it's not as prudently right. invested than a business would. And so they also assume, and I mean, this is a truth, that we have a country that issues its own currency, the US dollar. We generate it, the government gets benefits from issuing currency. It's called seigniorage, where when that first dollar hits the economy, the government gets to spend it first. It has its full value until it moves through, and over time it declines slightly based on inflation and how different costs are rising. And so MMTers argue that the government should just issue currency to spend, skip the borrowing part altogether. Let's just print money, and let's keep printing money until we see inflation. And then they make the assumption that our Federal Reserve or the Treasury, whoever does the money issuance and economic management that they envision, that they can just stop the inflation whenever they want to and just perfectly tweak the money supply and inflation by just taxing people all of a sudden. I mean, they make a lot of assumptions of how this would go, but we've seen MMT in action in many countries, Venezuela, Argentina. And what I'm referring to is countries that have just loosely printed money, issued currency in order to finance their government operations, and they are suffering from hyperinflation to the point that Venezuela, which was the most prosperous country in Latin America about 30, 40 years ago, is now a collapsing economy that has resorted to barter because their currency has become, the Bolivar has become so worthless. not useful as a method of exchange, a means of exchange, because the value is so uncertain, it keeps changing by dropping, and absolutely worthless as a store of value. With 10,000% inflation, according to the IMF last year, that means if you had $10,000 at the beginning of the year, by the end of the year, the value of that would be only 10 cents. So you can't use it. The money is no longer usable. And that is what happens when you tell governments, just, you know, go ahead and spend all you want and just print the money.
Right. So I saw, or in a recent interview, President Trump indicated that he might be open to cutting programs like Social Security and Medicare. What do you think that the odds of that actually happening are?
You know, it's funny. I think there was a misunderstanding. I believe you're referring to his remarks at Davos.
Perhaps.
And they were asking him about entitlements. And a lot of people in the U.S. interpreted that as Social Security and Medicare. Mm. But I believe the president interpreted it as the welfare state. Because if you look at his comments, and I think we'll see this reflected in his forthcoming budget on February 10th, he talked about how the strong economy means that fewer people are on welfare, that they're going back to work, and that is how this administration is reducing entitlement spending, because they keep the economy strong, which means people actually opt to work instead of collecting a welfare check. But that's very different from reforming middle-class entitlements that are largely going towards people that are already retired or have reduced their hours worked if they're semi-retired. I don't think that's what the president was referring to, but I think the reason that was interpreted this way is that Democrats, of course, were in an election year, were looking for something to attack the president on, and so they interpreted it as Medicare and Social Security, and I think that's probably the headlines that you saw. But the president quickly came out on Twitter, of course. Mm. How else does a president communicate?
That's right.
With his constituents, and said, I have promised not to cut your Social Security and Medicare benefits. I have kept that promise, and I'll continue to keep it. So. Mm. That's what he said.
Well, I'm sort of bummed out. I was kind of hoping we'd open the door to having that conversation at some point, but
yeah,
probably pretty tough for any politician to actually try to go down that road.
You know, if you were going to do it, you would do it during a second term.
Right.
The question is he going to be the guy to lead on that? And he is a man who's been keeping his promises when it comes to what he said about securing the border. That's been a big priority for this administration, and also the trade concerns that the president had. That's been a key theme throughout his first term. So if we take him by his word, he might not be the guy to lead us down that grand bargain. Also something to perhaps give us some indication is he was also asked about the deficit and debt, and he recently said, who cares about the debt? And apparently in private conversations also told his advisors when they showed him the charts of how debt just goes off the charts in a roughly 10 years, he was like, well, I won't be in office anymore then. Mm. Why would I care?
Very encouraging. Very, 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 very encouraging. Perfect. Well, Romina, any closing thoughts?
Yes, I think that people who are looking at the markets and they see that Treasury bonds are still able to sell at low interest rates, I think it's giving us a false sense of security and the impression that the U.S. fiscal situation, which is highly unsustainable, doesn't matter as much, or at least not now. I think that the markets are actually underpricing the real risks because the U.S. can rely so heavily on the dollar as a way to basically export inflation. It allows us to issue more currency than would be possible if the dollar wasn't the world's reserve currency, because so many dollars, about half of the dollars created, leave the country and are used in international trade or in countries to stabilize their own currencies. So they're not moving throughout our economy. But that only works for as long as there isn't a suitable alternative. And as our fiscal situation becomes more and more untenable, and if our politics continues to be so divisive that we're sending a signal to international markets that, perhaps we're not such a good long-run risk. Perhaps there is some chance that we might make bad decisions and not deal with this before it becomes a full-fledged fiscal crisis, that could also spur the development of an alternative to the dollar, the dollarized payment system. And those are things that I don't think are being fully considered, and that we might actually, that there's a risk premium that we're not currently seeing, but that the risk of a fiscal crisis is very real, and the longer we wait to address what's driving the U.S. deeper and deeper into deficits and debt, the more likely that fiscal crisis becomes.
Got it. Well, Amina, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Where can Savage Nation learn more about you?
I would love for some of your listeners to follow me on Twitter at Romina Baccia. I'm also on Instagram for some of the younger folks at The Lucid Economist, and I'll be sharing my pieces and where I'm going to speak. This week I'm in South Carolina at Presbyterian College, so I would love for some folks to connect with me there and let me know if they have any questions.
Awesome. Well, Savage Nation, if you enjoyed this as much as I did, show Romina your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Follow her on Twitter and Instagram, and I'll list both those in the notes of the show. Thank you again, Romina.
Thanks for having me.
And until next time, keep fighting the good fight, because we are all in this together.